I'm on a mission to help high flyers just like yourself, who until now have let the fear of public speaking hold them back from making a bigger impact. Join me as I find out the secret sauce from the world's leading speakers to make your speeches more interesting, enjoyable to give, and impactful for your audience. That's the mission, and this podcast will get you there. My name's Victor Ahipeni, and this is the Public Speaking Secrets Podcast.
Speaker Nation, what's up? What's happening? Welcome to another episode of the Public Speaking Secrets Podcast. I'm your host, Victor Ahipeni. And today, we are lucky enough, some of you know, I used to run another podcast called the Youngpreneurs Podcast. And a couple of my guests I have seen that they've been really successful in the speaking industry, or they've been able to transition their expertise from that into speaking, and that speaking kind of plays this nice ecosystem back into their business. And there was none better than one of my past guests, who actually chatted a few times, Eric Tamundi. He's the co-founder of Now Innovation, best-selling author. He's been featured in a bajillion things, and he is now really hitting up the speaking world. Welcome back. Awesome to catch up again, Eric.
Hey man, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's good to see where you're at now too, and just see how things have progressed. I mean, in this global community that we live in, it's really fun. I mean, we've never met in person. Yeah, we've been connected for a few years now. So it's cool to sort of at arm's reach watch how everyone's growing and developing, and you're no exception.
Yeah, it is a crazy world, because I mean. Yeah, I lived in Canada. Got to know Rob Lafort by coaching his rugby team, and then he put me onto you. He said you're the person I should be talking to, and then had a couple of chats.
How confused he was, but that's okay. I'm glad we're here.
And even from then, it was I think you were my first guest that had spoken at a TEDx event, and that kind of sparked my fire to do that and tick that off after that. And so let's see what we can bring out this time. If we're to give people a bit of a background about what Now Innovations is, what you've done, and then kind of how you've been able to transition from being kind of the business owner to the business owner / speaker. How has that kind of come about?
Yeah, sure. So Now is an acronym for the Now of Work. There's a lot of rhetoric around the future of work. I get it. Like, it's coming, no doubt. It'll always be coming. And I think sometimes we get so lost thinking too far ahead that we don't really consider about what we need to be doing now. And so when we look at Now Innovations, is how do we help innovate within organizations so they can really, what we would call, future-proof their organization or be more future-ready. So we're talking a lot of change management. We're talking a lot of people and culture work. We've built an assessment we're calling the lived experience analysis. Another Helix assessment, which we call that the Helix because it's the DNA of an organization. And then my co-founder, Rocky Ozaki, he leads our implementation and execution with our clients. And he does a lot of design thinking implementation. He does a lot of sprint and OKR implementation. And really what that comes down to is to say, okay, look, in a world that's busier than it's ever been before, how do we get people talking? How do we utilize the best tools? How are we making sure that we're taking collaboration, agility, innovation, we're talking about transparency, authenticity. So many of these words are just empty buzzwords that people like to throw around because they sound good. What Rocky and I are really doing is taking these words, putting meaning behind them, and actually implementing them in organization in a measurable way, right? And that's the big thing that's missing, I think, in human resources, is that when we look at HR, primarily, it's a cost center. We spend on people. We spend. We don't invest in them. And the big difference between spending and investing is, if you were to buy a pair of shoes, you just bought a pair of shoes. You didn't really invest in a pair of shoes. If you were to buy a pair of shoes and then measure how many times you wore those pair of shoes for the $150 that you spent on them, then it's an investment, because you get to see sort of what the return per use was, what the cost per use was. And we think that if we can start to analyze people and culture and the future of work and innovation in the workplace, then we can shift the whole mindset of human resources to be something that's reactive largely to something that's proactive. So, you know, on the speaking side of things, the shift for me has been to say, okay, look, how do we try and understand a world that's busier than it's ever been before? Digital components like artificial intelligence, the Internet of Things, blockchain, while we're still considering, you know, human centricity, a sense of belonging, a sense of tribe, a sense of community. So really, I'm at the intersection of technology and humanity, I think, is really what it comes down to. And organizations often will bring me in when they're saying, okay, look, how do we attract and retain the right talent in a world that's busier than it's ever been before? How do we understand, you know, how we can get the most out of our people so that when they're at work, they're there because they want to be there and not because they have to be there? And so for the company, I've become the evangelist, I suppose, of this whole future of work or now of work concept. And my business partner and the people that we work with largely are working on the implementation side of things.
Nice. And I mean, I think that's the one of the harder things. I spoke to a guy who, Josh Smith, who runs events and fills events for people. And he said it's really difficult for them, that they're very selective in a lot of the speakers that they get because they've got to have the back end systems behind being able to be a speaker, like just the speaking yeah. side of things. If they've got this business, yeah, yes, they're gonna connect with people. They're probably subject matter experts, but they've got to have the ability to handle all the new business or the business mm-hmm. and things that they're going to generate. And it sounds like you're kind of the forward facing person. You're the one who goes out and represents the business, and then you've got to have someone behind the scenes who's actually going to deliver on anything outside of just your talks. And is it a good mix? Is that how I'm reading it right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, here's what I've learned. I mean, I think I've been on 200 stages now. Speaking is an art in itself, which is great. And the business behind speaking is something that I totally underestimated, and not in a bad way at all. I just didn't understand the positioning play, the marketing play, the PR play. Like you said, the after the talk play, what happens? If it's nothing, well, it's going to be really hard to continue on when you've got potentially, you know, say the 500 people in the room, that's 500 potential leads. And no, it's not about selling from the stage necessarily and trying to drive business, and always selling. I mean, as someone at the front of the stage, you want to give, I hate this term, but just you want to give value. Mm. And really, you know, what you want to do is you want to give a compelling presentation that gives people something to think about and something to act on. That's really what it comes down to. If that's true, then there's value there. And that's all well and good. And to be a great speaker, undoubtedly you have to have a fantastic presentation. And that's something I'm working on now and will be for the rest of my life. You know, the beauty and the blessing and the curse of being a speaker is that there's no finish line, right? Yeah. Like you've never made it, or you already have, you know, like I'm building my career and have my full-time job as speaking. Arguably I've made it. And if you guess anyone else in my shoes who have just done this, we'll say that we're just getting started. And because there's no finish line, it's fun because I've always got something to chase. I can always be better. I can always read an audience better. I can always have more relevant information. I can always thread and weave a story better. And that's really what I love about it most, because I'll just say quickly too, and I spoke at a land surveying conference, a hotels conference, a forestry conference, an innovation conference, and a real estate conference. Like, man, the message, while it might be the same, the art behind delivering a similar message to people with totally different backgrounds, totally different industries, totally different set of knowledge, that's where the fun part comes, because then I get to be so much well versed in other industries that I'm not familiar with land surveying per se.
Yeah.
But I can tell you, I learned a whole lot about it before, during, and after the presentation.
Mm. And then it's, yeah, the next time you do anything near that space, you're going to, like you said, read the audience better, be more relevant,
that's right.
Better relevant and better information. And I like what you're saying. Yeah, it's not all about sales, but it's not about sales as well. Like,
the thing is if you really focus on not selling and you focus on giving a compelling presentation, the best selling that you can do is to deliver a good talk that doesn't sell anything, which is sort of ironic, I suppose. But
I helped a guy craft a talk for a dental business owner's talk, and he closed six figures, and he wasn't allowed to sell from stage.
Yeah. Perfect example.
Yeah. And I mean, it was all about just creating that compelling narrative. It was like, here's how you can do your marketing for your business. Here's the pitfalls to look out for. Here's some awesome social proof on how I helped the dude who ran this business, this event, do it for his businesses. And then at the end of it, it's like, look, and these are the things you should look out for. Here's how to do Google ads. Here's how to do Facebook ads. Here's how to do SEO. Yeah, a very brief overview. And yep, it's all incredibly difficult. And this is what you should look out for when you're looking for a digital marketer to run your stuff. And well, who's the logical option when you're at an event? And yeah, everyone rushed to the back to try and get a strategy session with him. And he didn't even pitch that. They all knew that his booth was at the back. And give, and there was no kind of deal stack at the end or anything like that, and people loved it. Best speaker.
Such a perfect example. And too, you know, these people will want that speaker to come back to their organizations as well, you know, and forget the implementation side, just on the thought leadership and speaking side. I mean, it's great too.
And so run us through how you've gone from, you know, being in the trenches in your business to transitioning to the speaker side of things. Like, was it from getting smaller gigs and working your way up? I think you've got a speaking bureau that you work with to get you these.
I think I'm up to six or seven now, which is great. You know, and that's a big focus, because when you can have other teams help get the word out, a lot of it's positioning, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, when we first started, we built a tool that quantified culture within organizations. And so, say, Victor, you and I are both accountants, we might have a similar skill set, but I'm an accountant at a golf course and you're an accountant for the government. You know, while our jobs might be very similar, the life that we live is vastly different, right? And so if we could quantify those differences and put them in numbers, and now we could tell a better story to attract a better candidate, now that's pretty interesting to companies, especially when you're looking at certain sectors who are trying to differentiate and who are trying to attract talent. I mean, here in Canada, organizations in forestry, agriculture, mining, transportation, construction, apparel are having a tough time attracting talent. I mean, it's no doubt. It's really difficult to Instagram your job. And so it's when you're talking about old traditional sectors. And so the misconception is that you can't attract the next generation of talent. Now, if we can start talking about something bigger than just the work itself and the meaning and the purpose behind it and the life that you get to live, I mean, not everyone wants to be on 90 flights a year. You know, mm-hmm. I was on 90 flights last year. I'll probably be on 100 this year. Not many people want that, you know. Maybe family is really important. Maybe staying at home and having routine and stability and security is really important. I think the number is about 15% of us are cut out to be entrepreneurs. Yet we still glorify and glamorize entrepreneurship like it's something we should all do. I firmly disagree. And so if I can come in based on our analysis that we've done in the past and start to say, hey, look, here are some things that we should really be considering, and here's how we can look at the future of work and attracting and retaining talent, the story is totally different. And so from the results that we had from our initial work, we worked in forestry and finance, we worked with government, we worked with apparel. I started speaking at industry conferences based on the work that we did, and people found it quite interesting. So, you know, I had 40 events that I'd done before getting signed, ultimately got signed by my beloved National Speakers Bureau. Hats off to them. I love them so much. They ultimately made me who I am today on the speaking circuit and took a chance on a young kid who wanted to public speak. And since then, I think I've done 200 events now, and really sort of phased out of the consulting side and into the speaking. I found something that I loved doing, something that I had thought was a real challenge and something that I felt I could chase.
And with that, so you've gone with those first 40 events, were they you reaching out to people, people reaching out to you? What did the, yeah, the toing and froing and the negotiation process look like? Because, I mean, I spoke to a guy, Nick Bowditch, and he just literally has his speaking feet on his website, his travel. Like, he's like, I'm one of the few that will just throw it out. And he's represented by bureaus as well. He's just like a non-negotiable type speaker. But for the most part, you know, you're getting invited to a 50-person event, and then you're getting invited to a, you know, a 400-person event, and there's only so much of a budget that can go to each. How did it look for you then versus how does the negotiation and stuff happen now with some bureaus representing you?
At the start, I mean, the thing is exposure is really important for bureaus. And the other thing is they don't build speakers, they sell speakers.
Yeah.
And so if you can prove yourself to be profitable for them and that you're generating dollars, that's what they need. Now, the question is, how do you get that first paid gig? Well, I think my first paid gig was $250. The second one was probably the same. The third one was maybe $500. And what happened when in the early days is, well, still, I mean, first and foremost, most important, but I'll get into what that is in the early days, I said, okay, look, I'll do this if we film it. If you like it, it would be great to have a testimonial from you. We're talking two or three lines, nothing significant. And an introduction to two people who you think this presentation would land well with, right? And so, you know, if you're vetted by somebody, you know, Victor, if you told one of your pals or one of your conference organizers that I'm a good speaker, that I should come and speak, it's going to sound a heck of a lot better than if I go to submit my speaker proposal with my media kit and say all the same things that every other speaker is saying, right? So the question is how do you leverage other people's network and get in with them to say, hey, look, you know, Eric's a great speaker. You think he'd be great. Why don't you, at your event, why don't you have a quick call with him and see what you think? And so it takes time. You know, the line that I've heard time and time again is that an overnight success takes 1,000 days. Mm-hmm. And I've been speaking since I got signed November 2015. So I'm not even 3 years in. And if you look at the numbers on that, 3 years is 9,080 days, right? So I'm not even at 1,000 days yet. Yeah. on professionally speaking. And man, like I said, I'm just getting started. Like, holy, there's so much to learn around the business and the speaking and the story flow and everything else that it's going to be well over another 1,000 days before making it. And when I get there, I can pretty much be sure that when we jump on our next podcast again, I'll tell you that I'm just getting started all over again.
With the business side, what's the biggest thing that that's kind of opened your eyes, or the biggest learning point that you've changed or implemented into your speaking business since you've kind of been going at it balls to the wall this year?
Case studies are so important. You know, we worked with a dentist, you know, for example. We haven't worked with dentists, maybe at least. We worked with a construction company, and they were having a really difficult time onboarding clients. And so what we did is we did blah, 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 blah. And we used this as a story, and it's real, and it's ours. And I didn't read it in Forbes, and I didn't do some sort of peer-reviewed journal research. This is what happened. This is a real issue. This is what they came to us with. This is how we solved it. And this is what the impact of solving that was. I mean, man, when we're working with clients and anyone on the marketing side of things, on the sales side of things, whatever, on the leadership side of things, especially, if you've got a business that you're running on the side, or if you've got people that are helping you with that, telling those stories on stage in a relatable way where whoever's listening be like, oh yeah, we have that problem too. Oh, that's what they did? Oh, that's what the result was? Oh, I had no idea. Value, value, value. It's all there. The other thing is the work that my co-founder does is great. Number one, he's really good at it and enjoys it. And I don't, you know, straight up, I do not enjoy doing the work that he does, which is phenomenal. So, I mean, I would say that when you're looking on the business side, find a co-founder and a team that does not have the same skills as you, that mm-hmm. have the same goal and that want to have the same outcome. Sure. But if they're doing the same thing as you and want to do the same thing, and you've got two people butting heads that are, you know, fighting over nothing, it doesn't work. I mean, I'm on the vision to execution scale. I'm 95% vision, 5% execution. And my business partner, I got to give him more credit than me. He's probably 70% execution and 30% vision. And to know that I say like, hey, what do you think about this? And he gets it because he thinks at that level. And I said, okay, well now what does this look like? He's like, okay, I got it. And then just starts like scratching stuff down, whiteboard stuff, comes up with something really cool. I'm like, yeah, this is my vision executed, or our vision executed, and it works really well.
That's awesome. And with your speaking side of things, like you kind of touched on it, like using the real life examples and stories, because obviously stories are so important. I spoke to David Nihil, who's the author of Do You Speak Funny? And it's a really, really good humorous book. How much humor do you bring into your talks in different industry side of things?
My girlfriend will tell you that I use a lot of dad jokes on stage, which is just like inherently lame. And I think that's kind of it. I'm more self-deprecating.
Yep.
I mean, I can talk about this narcissistic job hopping, not loyal, basement dwelling, Xbox playing generation. Of course, I'm referring to the millennials, and people will know who I'm talking about before I get to the fourth word. You know, I often say that there's 400 hours of video content that's uploaded on YouTube. And I mean, it's no wonder none of my stuff gets viewed, right? And so, you know, the more I can shoot myself in the foot, and people were like, yeah, obviously, or yeah, me too. To me, it's more about how do you have a relatable comment that people can latch onto. One other thing I'll say though too, is that what I'm trying to watch most or study most is not Gary Vaynerchuk or Tony Robbins or Oprah or Simon Sinek. I mean, the way that I see it is thought leadership doesn't exist anymore. Anything that Tony or Simon said before or Oprah said before, you're like, yeah, I mean, I get it. It's very inspirational. But the reason I think they do so well now is because while thought leadership might not exist anymore, delivery leadership does. And the way they command the stage and the way they deliver their material is, again, an art in and of its own. And I'll take that one step further by saying what I'm watching now is comedians. Comedians' delivery, oh, it's like, it's impeccable, man. It's unbelievable to see how seemingly unscripted their material is for an hour. So much that seems off the cuff, it's really not. So much that seems so real and so for the first time and spontaneous, it's not. And that's obviously no slight. That's their profession, and it is really, number one, funny, but they're just so good at what they do that I think that I, as a speaker, can learn more from a comedian's delivery while still preserving my own thought on the topic. That doesn't mean I'm trying to be funnier. I just think that, you know, what they often do too is they'll start, and it's a storyline, right? So last night I was in LA and da 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 da, you know, and then from there, that's where their storyline starts. And they'll weave in and out of that story arc and come back to it later. And half of what makes a comedian funny is that they'll come back to something you don't even remember them talking about. They're like, oh yeah, that's what he or she was talking about. I totally forgot. And that's what's humorous about that. So if I can take thought leadership, more of a deep TEDx style presentation, and still weave a story arc in, I might come and talk about generations. And then I might talk about technology. And then really what I'm talking about is a sense of belonging and human centricity. And the more you can weave back into something that you hadn't connected the dots on before, I think the more compelling, at least in my space, I could be. So again, there's no right style when they're speaking. There's no one right way of doing it. I think the better we understand ourselves, the better we can be on stage too.
And I think one of the big things with not just humor, but speaking in general, but what comedians do really well is a listener. So a listener to the show or a listener on stage or whatever, they are trying to connect the dots and answer what you're about to talk about for the next five sentences. But a comedian doesn't let you do that because they're controlling the narrative really well.
Right.
And you're like, oh, I think I know what's going to happen. And then when it's a very blatant, oh, I know what happens, and then it happens. Your brain's like, oh, okay, well, I was expecting that, and that's what happened. Whereas, and it doesn't get as much of a laugh. It's like, oh okay.
Having an element of surprise in that sense is great. There's also one other trick that I've just sort of learned recently. And, I'll tell you what happened. What happened was the guy said, I'm going to tell you what happened, and then paused. And then immediately you're like, this is awkward. What happened? And then he said, and what happened was, and they kind of got into it. And I remember him, I was on the call with him, and he was a lifetime speaker, like really good, did really well. And I remember four or five times he said, and let me tell you what happened. What happened was, and I'm sitting there on the other side of the phone for all like 1.5 seconds being like, what happened? Like, tell me what happened. And I'm like so hooked to figure out what happened that I'm so engaged in whatever the story is. And so pausing and breathing, you know, one of the biggest faults that I'm always working towards right now is saying more with less, you know, and pausing and taking that time for things to sink in. And boy, it's a work in progress. I'm nowhere near where I want to be yet. But the more you can draw people in with silence, the power of silence is just crazy. And I'm just starting to learn that.
I think a lot of those, and here's what happened. Like those, it's like, right. It's like copywriters, things to hook people on. It's like, so here's the thing. But here's the thing. And people are like, oh, what's the thing?
Tell me the thing.
Yeah. And it's almost like a brilliant way to transition to the next point, but it's also another way to re-engage your audience's brain when they start dropping off and, oh, but here's the thing.
Tell me.
And here's the thing. Here's what happened.
man. And the thing is you can't just do it either. You have to do it well, because people are, they know that that's a trick, you know, and you don't want to be tricked. And so they're like delivery, again, thought leadership versus delivery leadership. Delivery leadership is, I mean, you and I can come up with 100 thoughts. I mean, lock ourselves in a room for a weekend and we can write a book, right? I mean, that's fine. And you and I can come up with a whole bunch of different ideas. Now, putting them together with a compelling story, my book came out last year, as you know, and the writing took half the time as the editing, half the time. And then it took another couple months to get out to the world. And you and I can write a book this weekend if we wanted to. And then two, you know, writing a book that reads well and that's compelling, man, that's totally, totally different.
Yeah, I've got to figure out where a comma goes in a sentence before I... but on that point, how has having a book, or how has this book helped your speaking, or helped when you're at events, having that book from a social proof standpoint, or from a business generation standpoint? Is it, or not at all?
I mean, it has, and it has quite a bit. I'm pausing because there's no, what works for me might not work for somebody else. I mean, I'm a first time author, right? I chose a boutique publisher in Toronto, Barlow Books. It was a fantastic experience. That said, I'm dealing with a Canadian market, right? I'm not even in the States at all. I mean, you can get the Kindle version and that's great. The market in Canada, as you know, in the Southern Hemisphere, it's not huge. It is what it is. What I'll say is that I made money in the book, not a ton. I mean, very, very small amount, which is fine, in full transparency. But what happened is I got a ton of media that came along with the book. Forbes, a lot of our national media, national radio, national news, Inc., Thrive, Huffington Post, and on and on and on and on. And that's what I now use in my biography. That's what I use in my website. That's what I use in my speaking reel. Because now what happened is they validated the thoughts that I've got in my book. I mean, our national newspaper, the Golden Mail, you know, the title was, "What Does This 24-Year-Old Know About Work?" It turns out quite a bit. And to get support on a national level like that from unbiased people who are critics, now all of a sudden when I go to get a speaking gig, I can say, you know, the Globe and Mail, Sirius XM, Forbes, they like what I have to say. This will now de-risk you hiring me. And what I've found, whether you're selling a marketing product or you're selling a speaker, if you can de-risk the buyer, so the person who's signing your contract, if you can de-risk yourself from that person and immediately make them look as good as possible and have their boss tap them on the back and say, you know, great choice, before even I hit the stage, great, you know, and that makes it a lot easier to be chosen. I think that's why a lot of speakers have a tough time getting into it, because there's nothing that's validated you. People have to take a risk. And when the speaking space is so competitive and there's so many people in it, and there were so many great people doing it, why would I take a risk for 500 people in front of 500 people to bring in this kid who doesn't know what he's talking about when I can get a seasoned veteran for the same price and go from there? Yeah. And so what I would say to anyone who's starting out is get other people to validate you as frequently and as powerfully as possible. And then you de-risk yourself from anyone else who's trying to, from anyone who's booking you.
And I think that's a brilliant point. I did like a solo episode on just building your social proof, you know, whether it's a book, whether it's whether it's running a podcast, getting the media, using it as an ecosystem to all, you know, build up themselves, whether it's doing other speaking gigs, because like qualifications are just qualifications in the end. That's never going to, you know, unless you're speaking in your industry of a university degree, you're a doctor and you're a doctorate of physiotherapy, then, you know, people will sign you to speak because they want you to speak off your research. But if you're, you know, if you're doing other things, you know, if you're a business builder for physios, different story. You know, having a doctorate in running isn't going to teach people how to do businesses. But, you know, kind of the book, the podcast, the speaking engagements that you've previously done, testimonials, and the media is the biggest one to give you that social proof to de-risk. I love that word. Like, it's probably going to be frequently used now within the show. I'll reference you where I can, but it's I think it's
all yours.
It's a brilliant thing for people to take into consideration. It's like all these little nuances behind the scenes from speakers who are out there doing it in the trenches and giving you actual advice, not the advice that they've heard from someone. So thank you so much for that. I love outside of your book, which we'll link at publicspeakingblueprint.com, what is the biggest book that's maybe had an impact either on your business or your speaking side of things?
Easiest to answer that on the business side is a book called Small Giants by Bo Burlingham. It talks a lot. Do you guys have Cliff Bars?
Yes. Yes, we do.
So Cliff Bar, I mean, the quick story is Cliff Bar, that's it. That's the only product they have is Cliff Bar. And they were approached, I think, by Pepsi or Quaker, or, you know, the big giants to be bought out. And there's a few case studies of craft breweries and small firms and stuff that have done really well. And what they decided is they've got, I think it was like 150 employees. They've got make X dollars a year. They're on a growth trajectory. And they said, hey, look, we like who we work with. We like the life that we're living. We like the product that we've got. We're not going to sell out to the big company and be another cog in the wheel. And really, that shifted me from thinking, okay, I don't want to be another major 2,000 person consulting company that gets acquired and grows and grows and grows and then goes public and all this stuff. And like, I really like the life that I'm living. I like the trajectory we're on. I like the growth. And so to me, the shift on that book was it's quality, not quantity, in terms of staff and titles and stuff like that. You know, I mean, if we can define success and what it means on our own terms, you know, we can be a small giant, is really what it comes down to.
That's awesome. Well, I just want to welcome you to our Speaker Nation and thank you for being on the Public Speaking Secrets podcast. As always, it's just sweet chatting to you. If people want to hear more about your journey from the business side of things, jump over to the Youngpreneurs podcast on iTunes and have a listen there. But again,
I might have to do that too. Yeah. Hear what was going on.
Yeah. It's like, oh, wow, I was doing that and this is where I was going. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, yeah. If people want to connect more with you, find out more what your business is up to and things like that, where can they go? What can they do?
Yeah, check out LinkedIn is my primary platform. Reach out, say hi. Would love to chat. And my personal website, if you're interested in the book or the speaking or anything else, it's just firstnamelastname.com. I'm sure you'll see it on the episode, so I don't have to spell it out, but it'll be there, and happy to connect.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, and look forward to our next future chat.
I'm looking forward to it, man. Take care.
If you want to fast track your confidence and impact with public speaking, then be sure to jump over to publicspeakingblueprint.com, where there's an array of free resources to help you no matter where you are on your journey to becoming a more powerful speaker. And while you're at it, jump over to Facebook and join our free community called Speaker Nation, where there's a ton of other like-minded individuals just like yourself looking to level up. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you don't miss next week's episode.